I wanted to get a sense first of when you first became interested in mathematics. Did it go back a long way?
Well, yes. Certainly to junior high school, I suppose. I remember liking geometry when I first saw it. And I'm pretty old, but they did have AP calculus back then, and I took that, found that most intriguing. Somewhere prior to the course, the summer before I took calculus, I bought a calculus book for 10 cents on the used bookshelf and could make neither head nor tails out of what all these funny symbols were. So that was quite exciting to learn what it was all about. But it was not a foregone conclusion. When I went off to college, I was either going to major in math or history. That was my other interest and remained so. And so my career has taken the curious path where I can actually fuse those two and much later. But I chose math, though. Everybody told me it's more practical, you know, do mathematics. So I guess I did. I'm certainly glad I did.
Mm-hmm. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Pittsburgh, in a suburb of Pittsburgh called Wilkinsburg. And went to the University of Pittsburgh, first generation college, and that was the nearby big school. Mm-hmm. So went there for undergraduate work and then to Ohio State for graduate school in 1969, at a very turbulent time in American history. There I met lots of good people that are still friends, including Penny, my wife. She was in the same Arnold Ross number theory course that I was, so we got to see the great Arnold Ross, and we met the Leitzels. I guess I should mention that Joanne and Jim Leitzel were young faculty at the time, and both have been good friends and guides to us, I think, as we've moved through our careers. They've influenced both me and Penny in interesting ways.
But were you convinced that mathematics was the way to go?
Oh, yes. By then I was, yes. And my PhD was in topology. And it was not even algebraic topology. It was point-set topology, which in 1974 was pretty much out of gas as a subject. And I remember telling Joe Farrar, who was the chair of the math department at Ohio State, later, I guess, but at that point was a professor of algebra, and he said, you've chosen the wave of the past. And in fact, no research institution in the mid-70s was looking to hire anybody that knew that particularly. You know, that was the great problems had been solved decades earlier. Nonetheless, I had a wonderful advisor named Norman Levine, and we did a dissertation together, and I enjoyed it. You know, that researching was great fun, but then I went off to a liberal arts college, and those skills quickly atrophied, never to resurface. So those are topology is way back there somewhere in my past.
Now, was that a place somewhere before Muhlenberg?
Yes, right. And there's the Leitzel story comes into it. Joanne Leitzel, as an undergraduate, had gone to Hanover College in southeastern Indiana. And her mentor there was named John Yarnell, who was retiring in 1975, and called up Joanne and said, do you know anybody that would fit in the Hanover College? So it was the old boy-girl network, I guess. And she put a note in my box and she said, you know, would you like to work at Hanover College? It's the most beautiful place in the world. And she was close to being right. It's this lovely school up on a bluff over the Ohio River. And I applied and got the job and was there for 17 years. So that was the first phase of my career, thanks to Joanne.
So I take it at that point there was less time for your research in point-set topology
related
areas, and
that's right,
more time for teaching, and were you developing a continuing your history?
That didn't immediately happen. You know, like most people, right after the PhD, I tried to extract some papers and publish them, and I did. But when I tried then to just venture out on my own as a topologist and think up a good topic to write a paper about, that wasn't happening. So, no, I spent an awful lot of the time in Hanover worried about teaching and worried about faculty governance. I got up through every committee in the world. And in those days, I didn't go to joint meetings. You know, I wasn't active in the profession or in the academy beyond the campus, really. It was a rather insular time. But Penny and I were newly married, raising a family. This was a rural campus, beautiful place. Kids could roam the campus and catch snakes and salamanders and all. So it was a wonderful place for a young family starting out. But my interest in history, you know, was still there. And I guess if you want to know the story as to what brought me to where I am now, a critical moment was in 1980. I'd been tenured at Hanover. I had a sabbatical coming. And my sister, by a complete fluke, was the math librarian at the Institute for Advanced Study. She has a library degree. Her husband was an English PhD student at Princeton. So she ran the library, and she said, "Hey, we got a great library. Why don't you come to Princeton?" And, you know, I was interested in history. They had every journal I ever sought was in their collection somewhere. It was amazing. But I wasn't a member. I wasn't, you know, up there with von Neumann or Einstein. But since my sister had the key, I could get in. So that's when I did my first serious look at history and math, and that was sort of analysis I was focusing on as a kind of link to topology. Some of that turned into the Calculus Gallery, eventually, the book that I published in 2005. So then I went back after the sabbatical, back to Hanover, back to all the committees. And then in 1983, the Lilly Endowment, which is an Indiana, you know, endowment, put out a challenge to small colleges in Indiana. So this was quite limited. If you're a faculty member and would like to teach a course for which there is no book, they would fund you for a summer to develop the course materials. So I thought, you know, the history of math via the great theorems is something I'd always like to teach. Not try to be encyclopedic about the history of math, but just look at a few masterpieces in depth. And so I asked the dean, you know, should I apply for this grant? And he said, "They'll never fund it." He was a historian. And I said, "Oh, come on." So he said, "Okay, try it." So I sent in the grant, and they fund it. So now I spend the summer developing what will become the Great Theorems, Journey Through Genius, eventually. The deal was you had to teach the course twice, you know. So I did, and it was popular, and I certainly enjoyed it more than anything else I'd done. So then the next piece of the story, I wrote an article for the Monthly about a Great Theorems course. And that was in 86, I think. And it was read by a woman named Catherine Showalter at Wiley. And so one day I get a call and she said, "You think this is a book?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know, it's just a course." Well, she said, "Write a chapter, send it to us." So I wrote a chapter on Cardano and the solution of the cubic. And she called me up and sent me a contract, and that became Journey Through Genius. And then things started changing, you know, when that book was published. So, you know, it was all sorts of weird forks in the road that you could have never predicted, and yet, you know, by choosing well and following them, I carved out a little niche here in this profession.
How did you end up at Muhlenberg then?
Well, that's the other piece of the Joan Hansel story, that Penny had done her MS with me in the early 70s, and I had to go to the Army somewhere in there, and she came along with me, and when we came back to grad school, she didn't continue, so she had a terminal master's at that point. When we went to Hanover, they needed some help in the math department. She taught. She eventually wins the teaching award at Hanover. She's very good, but she didn't have the degree, the terminal degree, the PhD. And so Joanne came back to receive an Alumni Achievement Award, and hears this story and says, "You need a PhD, Penny, you know. But, you know, I'm 40, she says. "Well, that's all right, we'll arrange it. We'll get you into Ohio State." So Joanne, who was now in the administration, got a visiting position for me, so I could come, the kids could come, and Penny enrolled in the Math Ed PhD program. That required a sort of master's level math background, which she had, but it also had the prospect of finishing in a finite amount of time. So we moved back to Ohio State. I was the visitor, she was the student, from 87 to 89, and then I had to make a decision of Hanover. I couldn't stay away forever, so I went back to Hanover with the kids and became the single parent. She finished her PhD in 90, taught a year at Wittenberg in Bill Higgins' slot. She actually lived in Aparna's house, at Bill Aparna's house. And then the question was, what happens to her? She's got this newly minted PhD. Hanover didn't want anybody else in math. You drive 50-mile radius around Hanover, there's not another four-year college. Mm-hmm. So we said, well, although we've loved it here, we got to move. And so this position called the Kaler Professorship at Muhlenberg was open in 92, and I applied and got it. So that it was really a family decision to mm-hmm. give Penny an opportunity to carry this to Allentown. Now, when we went, she didn't have a position yet, mm-hmm. but there was all these schools around. The guess was somewhere something would mm-hmm. turn up, and the very next year, Muhlenberg had a mm-hmm. position, which she took. So we've been in the math department together for over two decades. And
so it's a happy solution to the class of two body parts.
Exactly. Again, by a fluky mm-hmm. you know, kind of development. With Journey Through Genius, then I started speaking and writing more, and I've happily put behind me all of the those committees that I occupied so much of my time at mm-hmm. in Hanover and gotten into the profession. And now, you know, I wouldn't miss a joint meeting, you know, mm-hmm. for the world, but I look back at all those years when I was oblivious to the mm-hmm. profession. It was a sort of lost time, but nothing you can do about that. So, you know, that's how this whole thing developed. There's a quotation I like from Alexander Graham Bell, who said, when you're walking along a path, sometimes you should dive into the woods. Mm-hmm. Dive into the woods. Do something crazy, you know. Go someplace you've never been. And there's been occasions when I've done that and it's paid off.
So it doesn't seem a stretch to go from your Great Theorems book to focusing specifically on Euler.
No, that's right. As I was writing the Great Theorems, needless to say, a whole bunch of them were his, and, mm-hmm. and I got to you know, really appreciate the power of this guy. And I mean, the way the Euler book came into being was I was at a party. This is amazing. It was at the Leitzels' house. There we go again. In 1990, the summer meetings were in Columbus. It was the 75th anniversary uh-huh. of an organization that had been founded in Columbus. Mm-hmm. You know, so they went there. The Leitzels have a party, and Don Albers is at the party. And I had never met him before, and he had read Journey Through Genius. He says you should do an MAA book. And I said I don't have an idea. And nonetheless, he whips out a contract. I literally had it in his pocket. So, you know, I signed a contract to do a book for the MAA, but it was understood that I wasn't going to force this. It was going to be a book that was going to arise organically whenever I was ready. And that was in 90, and it wasn't until probably 96, after any number of meetings where Don would collar me, you know, and say, you know, what? I don't have an idea yet. But by that time, I had given enough talks that I was starting to collect Euler material, you know. I would talk on Euler's number theory somewhere, I'd talk on his analysis, and I started to see a book emerging from the mist if I filled in, mm-hmm. you know, the interstices with a year of research. So I had a year, Muhlenberg gave me a year off to do research. It wasn't a sabbatical, it was better than a sabbatical. It was a whole year full pay mm-hmm. to do whatever I wanted, and so that was 97 and 98 and 99, the mm-hmm. Euler book hit the streets. And it turned out to be fortuitous because he was a 300th yeah. birthday was coming yeah. up. And, you know, I had chosen that topic because of birthday, but whenever 2007 came along, I was one of the people that was a mm-hmm. go-to person for Euler because I had happened to write this book.
Now, were you out there following in Euler's footsteps, literally, in Europe, or was it a different kind of research?
No. I was not. No, it was a research through reading the Opera Omnia, you know, the collected works of Euler, which mm-hmm. Lehigh University had. It was that's within 20 miles of us, you know. So I mm-hmm. drive over there and spend a lot of time mm-hmm. using those books. Now Muhlenberg has the Opera Omnia because the Kaler family, who funded my chair, honoring the senior member of their clan, who was a longtime professor there, the son came by one day and he said, hey, I want to give the department some books for the library. What do you need? And he ran into me and I said, we need the Opera Omnia. And he was, you know, very generous and had a fat checkbook. And so now it's a small college, Muhlenberg has these. And so I now just have to walk across the street to, to get any volume of his mathematics. So that was nice.
You haven't written a large number of books.
No.
How do you find the writing process?
Well, I love it, provided I'm enthusiastic about the topic.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just between us and the camera over there, the second book I did, The Mathematical Universe, was for Wiley.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it had come on the heels of Journey Through Genius. They sent me...
Which was a big success.
That was a big success, right. So they sent me two more contracts, you know, and I said, well, I might have one more book in me, an alphabet book. I had that idea. But I signed another one, which I still have in my desk, you know, I mean, I never... But when I got into The Mathematical Universe, which they wanted pitched at a lower level than Journey Through Genius, it was the hard one to write.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of it was, you know, you're committed to the alphabet.
Yeah.
You know, and there's 26 letters in this alphabet, and I was wishing, you know, we only had 20 letters or something, because you keep doing these chapters, and it seems like you're not getting anywhere. So that was the one that was the slog. But Journey Through Genius was like the course I had taught. Euler was my love, and then the calculus gallery on the history of calculus was something that I had done on my sabbatical at the Institute. My favorite history of math book of all time is Thomas Hawkins' book on the Lebesgue integral.
Mm-hmm.
He's at Boston University, and last year when I was at Harvard, I actually got to meet him, and he was like, he was my hero, you know, that he had written this book. It was like an adventure story of how the Lebesgue integral came into being in the 19th century, after all of these bizarro pathological functions were discovered that that showed that, you know, the Riemann integral seemed too limited. And yet, what do you do? And Lebesgue writes the great thesis of the 20th century and answers it. And so that was great fun to write. You know, and then there's articles and so on. I'm pretty careful at writing. I like to pour myself into it. I like to be isolated, you know, and focused. I rewrite a lot. But when it's working, it's a great experience, as you know, to be creative with words and to have the pieces fall into place. It's just that I'm always reluctant to commit unless I'm really enthusiastic, because if you're not enthusiastic, then it's excruciating. You really want to do this, or else you shouldn't.
Now, several of your efforts have been collections where you're more the editor.
That's right. Well, the Genius of Euler, which, of course, was part of the five-volume onslaught in 2007, and that one, again, was pitched by Don. They wanted something for Euler, and I don't know where that was among the five in terms of, you know, its pitching, but this one was the one that pulled things out of past publications, mainly MAA stuff. And then presently now with Jerry Alexanderson, the hope is that there will be this book on Hardy. He and I have worked together. That's the first co-author I've had, in a sense. But we've not been face-to-face for one moment in this process.
Mm-hmm.
I've met Jerry, of course, back through the years. But so this is a weird kind of email existence.
Mm-hmm.
But he is amazing,
as
I'm sure you know. I mean, he's indefatigable. I mean, the stuff he does. You know, I mean, if this comes in the being, it's good that his name starts with an A, because he certainly should be first, and he should be in bigger font, I think, because his contributions have been just so amazing. So there's that.
Now, you've just retired from Muhlenberg.
That's right.
What are you looking forward to doing?
Well, here again, my retirement is kind of a bunch of serendipitous things coming together. I will tell you the story. It was... the year of Euler, 2007, and in that year I was invited all over the country to talk about Euler. But in November of the year's almost over, I get an invite from Harvard to go talk about Euler there. I had never been invited to Harvard. Now, they were a little late on the uptake. The year was almost over, but, you know, that was okay. So I go, I give my talk, and at the end, Benedict Gross and Cliff Tobbs come down and say, would you like to teach here? You know, and as I've described it to people, that was not a dream come true, because I would never have dreamed such a crazy mm-hmm. thing that somehow they invited me to come and teach mm-hmm. there. So, yes, was the answer. And so in the fall of 2008, I was at Harvard. They invited me back in the spring of 2013, mm-hmm. a year ago I was there. And although the first gig there was the best teaching I'd ever done, the second gig was better than the first. It was really great. I enjoyed it. The students were wonderful. And I was more part of the department. Mm-hmm. But then other offers start coming in. I think mm-hmm. if you got Harvard on your resume, other offers come in. So in next week, I start at Princeton mm-hmm. as a visitor. The next term after that, I'll be at the University of Pennsylvania as a visitor mm-hmm. doing history courses, math history. Well, when that started piling up, these grand opportunities to do what I most want to do at some of the best schools, you know, this side of the Atlantic at least, mm-hmm. then it was time to say goodbye to the day job mm-hmm. at Muhlenberg. You know, I can't keep asking them for mm-hmm. leaves of absence while I go off and have fun at mm-hmm. Ivy League schools. So that really pushed me to retire. Mm-hmm. Penny has one more term this term, and then she's retiring. Mm-hmm. And she says she's really retiring, but mm-hmm. But I'm hoping to, I think I might have written in my blurb here, to remain an itinerant mm-hmm. math historian for a while, if places will have me, mm-hmm. and, you know, carry the banner of Euler or Euclid or whoever, you know, to places which may not have such courses. I mean, Harvard is the greatest, you know, school around, but they don't have somebody that formally mm-hmm. teaches something like this. So there my course was just on Euler. Mm-hmm. It was for freshman and sophomore math major concentrators, as they call them there. And my title was Much Ado About Everything, which I thought was, you know, fit. And so I had, both times I taught it, I had great groups of students, mm-hmm. just fabulous. And not all math concentrators, actually. Mm-hmm. There were science types and history of science types and all. Mm-hmm. But we did serious math. It was the math that Euler did. So it wasn't modern, but it sure was brilliant, you know, and some of the stuff he does is just jaw-dropping. So, and with those kind of students, you know, you'll finish writing something on the board that is really cool, and you know it is, and you look out there and you see glazed eyes and big smiles, you know, that they get it too, you know. Mm-hmm. Unlike some students when you look out there, you know, checking their email or something. So that was just very rewarding in that sense. Mm-hmm. I thought I was succeeding in passing along this amazing story of Euler.
Now, you've been to Cambridge. Are more travels in your future?
Probably.
Is your or math, sorry, history or research oriented?
I don't know about research oriented. Penny wants to go to Australia and New Zealand, mm-hmm. and that'll be just a vacation. But you're allowed to have a vacation right. every once in a while, right? I don't know. I would love to go back to England just because I had such a grand time there. I could live there for a very long time, I think. But otherwise, no, we haven't quite gotten to that stage. Our retirement is not quite here yet, and we still have to move into a condo and all that, so there's going to be a little bit of time just to get our life in order. But by this time next year, maybe we'll be mm-hmm. off. Well, who knows? Maybe we'll dive into some more woods.
For tonight's talk, you're talking about Newton.
Right.
Who was in your Journey Through Genius, as
yep,
I call it.
That's right.
Back there. What brought Newton back to your attention?
I spent the summer of 2011 reading his correspondence. Mm-hmm. So I had looked through his mathematical works, which Cambridge published, but they also published the Newton correspondence in seven volumes. And I just thought, well, there's my summer project for this summer. I'm going to just see what he wrote in letters over the course of his life and what he received. They also have, you know, the exchanges. So it took a while. There's a lot of pages. Some of the letters, as I might say tonight, were fascinating, and some were dreary beyond measure. But I did it. I read them all. And then what my talk tonight is sort of my favorite excerpts, you know, some Newton's greatest hits or something. But what brought him back? Well, in a certain sense, I think the Cambridge sabbatical, just being around his lair, you know, where he was, his rooms. Whenever I would walk over to the Center for Mathematical Sciences, I'd walk through Trinity, and you could look up where he did all this stuff, you know. And there was the dining hall where he would forget to go eat, you know, that sort of thing. And in the Wren Library at Cambridge, they have his Principia marked up for the second edition, where he himself, you know, writes on it. And it was kind of cute. On the front page of the first edition, it's by Isaac Newton. By the second edition, he's Sir Isaac. So he writes in, comma, K.T. Knight. You know, he wants to make sure that nobody forgets that. And over at the CMS, as it's called, the Center for Mathematical Sciences at Cambridge, one of the buildings is called the Isaac Newton Institute. So, you know, somehow he was sort of back on my radar screen, and I think that's why I read the correspondence. Now, this is not to say he was the nicest, warmest, friendliest of people. Au contraire, he was sharp and difficult and challenging as a person. But as a thinker, he was second to none.
Now, that correspondence covered his full lifetime?
Yes, right.
Of which about a good almost 30 years was spent really as an administrator.
That's right, yes.
Rather than as the working mathematician.
That's right, yeah. His active mathematical life was over way before his real life was, you know, as he serves in Parliament for a while, and mainly he serves at the Mint, and gets very rich.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yes, he got very rich, but nobody would accuse him of stealing, because Isaac would not have done that, but he knew the bankers in the city, he knew the government officials, and he knew how to invest, I guess. But he ends up with a nice estate, and nobody to give it to, because he had no offspring.
Now, if there were one person, mathematician or otherwise, whose feet you would want to be, you would want to be with, just to experience them for real, who would that be?
Anybody. Wow, now that's...
The simple answer would have been Euler.
Right, the simple answer would have been Euler. And that might be true. Maybe...
It would be
Bertrand
intriguing to hang around
Bertrand
with.
Bertrand Russell would be very intriguing to hang around with, you know. And my life and his overlapped, actually. He's always been a favorite. It's sort of this British, slightly eccentric, brilliant wordsmith. Just an incredible character on the stage. The story of Russell is he remembers sitting on Queen Victoria's lap, and he lived to see men walk on the moon. You know, now that is quite a span. And in that period, just about anybody who was anybody, you know, he knew or taught or something. So, you know, he knew Lenin, and he knew Wittgenstein, and he knew T.S. Eliot, and so on. So he'd have made an interesting conversationalist, although he was kind of a difficult guy, too, I think. Lincoln, I mean, if we're going to expand well beyond the sciences, who certainly lived in this city for an important period of American history, I've always admired him. So there's a couple. Yeah, and then we'll throw Euler in there.